Hi everyone, and welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. Ryan Ballinger, great to have you with us. It's June 19th, 2023. Hope you had a great U.S. Open week. Hope you enjoyed what was a fantastic championship. We'll talk a little bit about LACC as a venue, what that means as a golf course, what it means for 2039, what the makeup of the 22,000 people who were there each day, what that might mean about golf, a whole bunch of other stuff. Obviously, we'll talk about Wyndham Clark as the champion, Rory McIlroy is the runner-up. Scottie Scheffler is a guy who can't seem to make a putt, but is still somehow in it every single week. And anything else we get to in the back end, we'll get to in the back end. But you can get a hold of me at Ryan Ballinger on Twitter and Instagram, or you can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Should apologize for not doing shows the last couple of weeks. So the prior week, I was out of town, and then I went out of town on purpose for vacation and wound up having my uvula, you know, the thing in the back of your throat, enlarged, and it happens very occasionally when I'm sleeping, I mean, like every couple of years. And what it does, it makes it really hard to kind of swallow and also really weird to talk. So, especially for long periods of time, like I would be doing when I'm doing a podcast. So, I didn't do any podcasts while I was away, but I am okay now and I'm back, and hopefully, that won't happen again for a while. It is a really strange feeling, and hopefully, you've never dealt with it before. But we do have plenty to talk about, obviously. Let's start with Wyndham Clark, who is your new U.S. Open champion. Won on 10 under par, 270, beat Rory McIlroy by a shot. And I have to give credit where it's due, and I think a lot of people are not going to do this. I think a lot of people are going to say Rory McIlroy should have won, but for the following things that probably he could have controlled but didn't control, right? People are going to talk about Rory McIlroy bogeying 14, the atrocious wedge from 125, probably should have just gone for the green at that point in the tournament. Instead, decided to lay up, but I think he had more value in trying to go for it than what he wound up doing. He knows he's not a great wedge player, but instead leaves a full wedge, winds up missing the green, embeds his ball, gets a fortunate break because it embedded, still was not able to get up and down to save par. That bogey was huge, really created a situation for Wyndham Clark where he knew he just kind of had to hold his nerve and get the job done. And that's no small task, and we'll get back to that. And also the par on 8, when he got so close in 2, I mean, it was practically a gimme 2 putt. I know the greens are fast, I know it's difficult, I know it's U.S. Open, but for a man of that caliber of player, that capability, that should have been a birdie. And that's the difference between winning and losing the golf tournament. And for him, and I will credit McIlroy for saying after the fact and talking to Garrett Banks, you know, I'm going to keep putting myself there. I'm going to get myself in position and get one of these things. And then in the news conference after, he said, I would go through 100 of these types of experiences, 100 Sundays like this one, to get to win another major championship. And McIlroy is so good at giving us in the media community that kind of catnip of like, oh, swoon about Rory. And I love watching Rory McIlroy play, but it is a real struggle to, if you're a fan of his, to pull for him. And I try very hard to separate the golfers I enjoy watching personally from the ones I might talk about publicly, you know, and the tone in which I talk about them. I love watching Rory McIlroy play because he's an incredible driver of the golf ball. He keeps putting himself there. He's so consistent. It really is enjoyable to watch. He is also tremendously bad with a wedge in his hand. He is a streaky, at best, putter. He has some very clear flaws in his game, and yet over the course of 15 years of him being a relevant public professional golfer, he hasn't gotten that much better at them. He is who he is. And that is a bad wedge player, a guy who just added another wedge as though that was going to change the equation. That's not it. And it's really hard to find yourself, if you're being a golf fan, like when I'm a golf fan, it's so hard to get invested in him because, not because he's not likable, not because his game's not admirable or he's not an admirable person. I think all of those things are true. He also has tremendous flaws, right? I mean, and we've seen them over the years. He can be petulant. He's learned to kind of curtail that publicly. He can be spiteful. Again, learned to curtail that publicly over time as he's realized maybe it's better to be a face instead of a face for good as opposed to a face for, I don't know, something mediocre. Saw an opportunity there, and I think has made the right advancements in his career and his personality, persona, to get where he needs to be. But as a golfer, this is the Rory McIlroy experience. And I found him over the weekend, again, trying to win a major by playing safe. He did this at the Open Championship last summer. He figured 69-70 was going to be good enough to win, given the situation, given it was the 150th Open, given that the players around him had minimal or very little experience or no experience in winning major championships. It was a flawed strategy then that Cam Smith exploited with an incredible back nine and won the championship at St. Andrews. And it happened here again. McIlroy played a brand of golf, particularly in the final nine holes, but really throughout the course of the round, that was limited on aggression and was really trying to pick off certain spots by playing smart and making birdies instead of playing the normal brand of Rory McIlroy golf that leaves you to the spectacular shots that he hits and the club twirls and all this. He was trying to do the smart things. Get in front of the green on 8 and 2. 2-putt. Well, then he got careful and he missed it. Trying to lay up on 14. Okay, it's hard to reach and no one was getting there anyway. Let's do the smart thing. Well, the smart thing might have actually been to put it in the bunker in the first place and try to get up and down. He didn't do that. It's almost as though he's determined that the best way for him to win majors is to play like him for the first half and then not like himself for the second half. And it hasn't worked. And when you run into someone like Wyndham Clark, who played a very steady brand of golf, but also a very confident brand of golf, that mistake, that game of waiting for someone to fail, becomes extremely risky. Because now you have taken it largely out of your hands. If you're trying to hit the fat of every green, if you're just trying to two-putt, if you're giving a whole lot of respect to the putts, and he missed so many putts on the high side over the course of the weekend, it was staggering. It's like he was giving them 6 inches of extra break, so he knew he wouldn't miss on the low side and it wouldn't go away from him. He would just miss by a couple feet at worst. It was very much a conservative strategy, or at least the way that it played out looked awfully conservative. It may not have been a strategy, right? I mean, he's trying to make putts. But he was trying to make them in a way I think he doesn't normally try to make them if you watch him week to week on the PGA Tour. And when you try to change the way you play golf to win a major, I think that is hard to do. Not that you can't, I just think it's hard to do. And you need to be able to be comfortable turning on and turning off if you're going to do that, and I don't think he is. So you either got to play always on or a very conservative strategy at all times. Well, I don't think the conservative strategy can really work anymore in most majors. You can't do it that way. Golfers are too powerful, they hit the ball too far, the equipment's too good, they're too good. They're going to make birdies and eagles eventually. They might not make eagles, but they're going to make birdies. And they're not just going to fall backwards in free fall. And that'll get to the discussion about Los Angeles Country Club in a little while. But you can't expect a modern player to just go, oh, well, I'm just going to bunt it down there and hit the fairway and bunt it down to the green, hold the green, two putt, just keep knocking out pars and running out the clock. McIlroy was trying to do that, but from behind against a guy that wasn't trying to do that. Wyndham Clark played like a guy who wanted to win the golf tournament and was going to win the golf tournament, not like a guy who was just waiting for it to come to him because he was in the pole position of being in the last group. Went out trying to make birdies. He knew he would make bogeys. He minimized the damage, which I think was extremely important to him the entire course of the week, but particularly on Saturday and Sunday. When he got himself into tricky, difficult, unenviable positions where it looked like he was going to blow up, I think most people were like, all right, here we go, here he comes. And I tweeted once, uh-oh, when he hit, I think it was on 8. And it looked like, or maybe it was 9, it looked like he was in deep trouble a couple of different times over the course of the weekend, 17 on Saturday. And he instead correctly assessed the situation, decided that he was going to do the smart thing, but then play well from there. And his short game was impeccable. He knew when he was in trouble, he could he had a better chance of getting out of it than his other peers, right, his competitors. And he executed. And at the end, we could talk about how smart he played. We could talk like he played to win. We could talk about him relying on that big banana fade. We'll call it a slice. That's what it was. He hits a slice. And he knew where he needed to largely start it to get it into play. When he got it into play, he didn't make a whole lot of errors. When he did, he got up and down. He executed the shots. I mean, yes, he was smart and he did the right things mentally, but he executed the shots. And that combination is what makes you a major champion. McIlroy didn't do that. And as he mentioned to Cara Banks, the margins are so small. We just came up with three places where he could have easily changed the fate of this tournament. And he didn't. And that, again, is a small margin, but that's the difference between him being still a four-time major champion and him being a five-time, six-time, seven-time major champion. So the good news is for him, he keeps putting himself in this position. And he doesn't seem, I guess, too heartbroken that it hasn't worked out yet, right? He's about to go to a venue next month where he won the Open Championship, a place that feels a lot more like a regular parkland golf course in the United States that he loves compared to a genuine open links-style punisher of a venue. And that's not to say it can't be difficult at Liverpool, but or Hoylake, depending on which name you want to use. But that is that's the saving grace here for McIlroy, is that he's got one more this year. He seems to have found some confidence again after a very difficult start to the year. He's gotten better, but he is still who he is. And for him to win a major, he's going to have to improve his wedge game, his short iron game, his control game. He is a guy who much prefers to hit full shots into greens than figure out how to be comfortable hitting three-quarter, 80%, 65% shots. He just does not have that comfort level for a guy that hits that many of those wedges. And I don't understand. I've never understood it. But that's the difference. If he can just figure that out one or two times more, for one, even just for a few days in majors for his career, he would have six, seven, eight of these things by the time it wraps up. But he hasn't done that yet. Now, to Wyndham Clark, guy who won this tournament. We just talked about he did the right things. He played the kind of golf that you need to play to win a modern major, which is drive it far, putt it well enough, don't make big mistakes, and be just proficient enough with your approach play to win. He was 43rd on the week in terms of strokes gained on the approach. That's the back two-thirds, or back third almost, excuse me, of the field. That's not great. But it's better than where he's been. And again, going back to McIlroy's comment that the margins are small, if they are that small, and they are, then a minor improvement can mean the difference between winning and losing. And we've seen this in several players in recent years. Wyndham Clark is the latest. Max Homa is probably the most recent and obvious, where a golfer has become better, at a marginally better, not dramatically better necessarily, but marginally better at a skill they were not so good at, and they still maintain the other skills. Wyndham Clark is still an athletic, tall dude who hits the ball a long way. He played on a golf course where he could get away with a flailing fade. It was fine most of the time, save for a couple of instances. And he's got a great short game. I mean, he did get some breaks. Don't get me wrong. Everyone gets breaks when they win golf tournaments. But he applied himself very well when he got a break. And he knew how to execute the shots he needed to execute. He had the imagination and the gall to try them, even when the tournament was on the line. And it all came together for him. And that lag on the 18th green, 72nd hole from 59.5 feet to a foot, you're not going to see a whole lot better than that in the history of major championship golf, knowing that all you have to do is two putt from a mile away, but if you do it, you win. That was really impressive stuff. So congratulations to him. Very cool to have his family around to celebrate with him. Obviously, his mom passed away, a decade ago, and that was very much on his mind and on his family's mind, and that was certainly emotional. It was cool for Ricky Fowler, who was playing with him on Sunday, to say after the fact, after he'd won, your mom would be very proud of you. That was really cool. It was a nice finish. I mean, is it the one probably NBC wanted or even the USGA necessarily wanted? No, they probably would have preferred McIlroy to win or Fowler to win or Scottie Scheffler to win. But at least you had a good story. You had a guy who played well. He didn't back his way into it. He played great golf. He was the better golfer. And in what he is good at compared to McIlroy being the better golfer and what he's bad at to be good enough to win. So now you've got Wyndham Clark, who's, I think, the fifth consecutive first-time U.S. Open winner in a row. So a tournament that has identified new major champions again and again and again. And frankly, in an era where parity is common, right? So that's not necessarily that's not a knock on the U.S. Open. It's just the reality of it. But there's going to be, I think, some element of introspection, some element of investigation into Wyndham Clark. He is kind of problematic in some ways. He thinks he's a January 6th truther. He is a plandemic guy. Has sent some tweets about those things. That's probably not going to endear him to some people. And some people are just never going to look into it. They're not going to know. But he's going to find himself in a different stratosphere now of attention and criticism and introspection investigation, not introspection. He might be introspective. That has nothing to do with winning a major. It's going to be interesting to see how he evolves here as a public persona, because he doesn't strike me as a guy who's just trying to be out there and be public except from like tweets from 10 years ago and the political stuff. So we'll see what happens with his public persona. And there is such a thing. There is a public persona these guys have, and Rory McIlroy's really good at it. Phil used to be good at it, not so much now. There are lots of John Rahm's become very good at it. Scottie Scheffler not so. I mean, Scottie Scheffler probably is the same guy in public as he is in private, that kind of thing. So everyone has their own approach to it, but Wyndham Clark's going to find his, and now he's going to have to be thrust into this world really quickly where now you're a major champion and your life has changed. And with which shape that takes from here, whether he wins again this year, wins a FedEx Cup, thinking about the Ryder Cup team, obviously, all kinds of different things are about to change in his life. And those changes, and how you react to them are going to dictate the next stage of his career. But congratulations to Wyndham Clark on winning the U.S. Open. All right, so let's talk a little bit about LACC, Los Angeles Country Club. North Course hosted the U.S. Open for the first time, and I think it did a good job. I think it was a good venue. I know a lot of people were going to take umbrage with it as soon as Ricky Fowler and Xander Schauffele, 20 minutes apart, put up 62s, which set the all-time record for a single round, and the first round, obviously, in a U.S. Open championship, knocking out all the 63s that started with Johnny Miller at Oakmont 50 years ago, right? And I think that got things off to a wrong foot, right? No one broke 80, or no one was above 80 in the first round. Never happened in a U.S. Open. You had just an unbelievably low scoring average relative to the U.S. Open. But I think if you look at it on the whole, you take the first round out of it to a degree, but still include it. You look at the lead from round one, it's -8, right? It only got two better. Now, in most U.S. Opens, the first round lead is about as deep as it gets, and then it starts to creep back toward par from there. But in recent memory, the last three U.S. Opens prior to this, the winning score was 6 under, right? So you have -10 here, 4 worse. Okay, or at least against par. But if you take that first round and consider what the scoring average was, then otherwise you probably would have gotten closer to that -6 number, which is seemingly kind of where the USGA is comfortable with at this point. And there was really nothing the USGA could do about Thursday. There wasn't much sun to work with. It wasn't particularly windy. There was really nothing to stop the players from going after practically every pin, and there were enough holes out there where you could score pretty easily, and then you had the par fives that weren't necessarily accessible, although most were, But the ball was rolling out far enough, because there hadn't been a whole lot of rain in May in Los Angeles, that the ball was still going to go plenty far. So even the really long par fours for the longer hitters were not that long. You were coming in at most with a mid iron. And for a lot of guys, eights, nines, somewhere in that range, a bunch with wedges. That's going to make any golf course pretty easy. But once the place firmed up over the weekend, the sun came out, got a little bit hotter, maybe a touch windier, but not really. Then you had a golf course that started to dry out. You had more difficult weekend pins, and the greens started to firm up. Greens rolled great throughout the course of the week. I did not see a single player in news conferences or post-round comments say that the conditions were any worse than perfect, any less than that. And when you're putting on perfect greens at a really good speed, things are going to go in the hole. And then they started to get a little bit quick. Not to the point that they lost control of them, not even close. But it gets harder to make those putts with the championship on the line when it's a little bit of, you know, half foot faster. It's all a little bit more difficult. But I think LACC largely held its own on Sunday. And I think it did on Saturday, too. If you look at the overall scoring on Saturday and Sunday, so let's take the top nine players for the sake of argument here, because otherwise we just wind up doing everybody. But for the sake of argument, on Saturday, you look at the top 10, top nine players, 269, 68, 71, 70, 74 for Minwoo Lee, 70, 66, 71. Okay? That's not bad. Best score among those is Tom Kim, who had a really nice Saturday, 4 under par. Worst score, 4 over par for Minwoo Lee, who turns it around on Sunday. Same group of people on Sunday. 370s, 67. Tommy Fleetwood, 63. Kudos to him, by the way, for becoming the first player in U.S. Open history to have a pair of final round 63s. And he would be, I think, the first person in U.S. Open history to have two rounds of the single round record, were it not for Schauffele and Fowler beating him in the first round. Minwoo Lee shot 67 in the final round. Fowler was the worst with 75. Tom Kim, 69. Harris English, 72. So a pretty varied number of scores. But the course largely held its own. I mean, the two guys who finished in first and second shot 1 under on the weekend, which, that typically is what you would expect from a winner, a U.S. Open champion, to just beat par by just one, and that be good enough. Scottie Scheffler was 2 under par for the weekend, came up 3 short in the end. You had Cameron Smith, who had 71 on Saturday, shot 67 on Sunday. A lot of years, at that 6 under total, that would have won the last 3 years. So he had a great, great week. Just because the score is 10 under par doesn't mean the course was easy. Minwoo Lee was very interesting, and he said this after his week, that he shot -5, and he worked his ass off out there. Michael Kim, who was playing in the U.S. Open, he's had a really nice year on the PGA Tour, his best, really, and he's won once, but this is his most consistent year. He said he thought this was a better test than Augusta National. And in some ways, maybe he has a point. There were some really fascinating holes. The long par fives are really hard. But also, if the ground is firm and the fairways are wide and there's plenty of room to run out shots, and that's not true on every hole, but there was on 18 where you could hit a 60-yard slice and still find the fairway, then these guys are going to figure it out. They're going to figure out how to find the fairway and score. And the only way you're going to really be able to limit scoring is to pinch in the fairways. So I think that's what's going to look like in 16 years, when this thing hosts a U.S. Open again. They signed up for two, which I think was very smart on the part of the USGA, and I think that's going to be their path moving forward, is do not have one-off hosts here and there. You're going to sign up for two if you want one. You're going to do one, you know, whatever year, and then another 10, 12, 15, 16, 20 years out, whatever it is. You're going to agree to that if you want this championship. So I thought the setup, other than the width of the fairways, was quite good. hole locations were good. I think they found the right spots on the greens. I think they played the long par threes the right way. I think they set up six appropriately. I thought six was a brilliant hole. You had three choices. Yeah, you could have gotten rid of the tree you have to hit over so you could kind of see better what was happening. And that might have been a little bit silly. But I still kind of appreciate the mystery of it, actually. I know some people were on Twitter. I think Brad Klein's one of those guys whose opinion I respect, but I disagree with here. He wants the tree to come down on six that was kind of blocking the path down toward the green directly, and to the right layup area, to the right of the green that would give you a better angle toward any of the pins, basically, than from the left, where you'd have to come in over the gunch, over the gross stuff, the bad long grass, to a narrow green. But the reality is, it just made sense to lay up there, one way or the other, because if you were coming in from the right, you had the proper angle. If you were coming in from the left, you had the backstop. So if you had to go over the tall, fine fescue and all that nasty stuff in the bunker, you were still going to be able to hit it past the pin, impart enough spin on it that you could probably bring it back and give yourself a chance for birdie. From the right, it might have been a little bit trickier in trying to get it to stop, but it was a pretty easy read in terms of where you put the ball up out to the right and let it just kind of feed down toward the hole. So that's why the scoring average was what it was for six. But that still made it a really interesting hole to watch because you weren't going to make it two, most likely. So if you weren't going to make it two, you had to find a way to make it three. And if you made a four, you felt like you lost out on something, which might have created this butterfly effect of how you play the rest of the round, right? And I don't think that's something we talk about enough in major championships, or any championship for that matter. Golf has this thing where the previous shots, your previous experience, of course, influences what you do the next time. It's just natural. It comes up, right? But you can see it in a way in golf. I don't think you can in other sports. Where, I'll give you an example. Let's go back to McIlroy. So, on number eight, he doesn't make the four-footer. And that sets him into motion where he thinks, oh, maybe I've lost. Maybe I don't have this. But if he birdies eight, and if he doesn't screw up the wedge, goes for the green and birdies 14, then maybe he's tied with Wyndham Clark down the stretch, and Wyndham Clark makes a mistake, and he loses the tournament. How about Ricky Fowler? Got a putt on 16, I believe it was, on Saturday, 6 feet, maybe 5 feet, for birdie to get to 12 under for the tournament. And if he got to 12 under at that point, I believe he had a three-shot lead. If he has a three-shot lead, and he gets to 18, and has a similar 5-6 footer for that par that he needed to have the outright lead for 54 holes, maybe he makes that and has a three-shot lead. That's a whole different ball game for Wyndham Clark trying to win a first major championship in a final group from three behind than it is from even against the guy who lost some of his mo with the very last putt of the final day. That stuff happens all the time. And we often, in trying to analyze or explain or talk about golf, we think about the blow-up moment, the bad moment, or the amazing moment, not the moments that set them up. And the moments that set them up are, I understand, more than just the prior day or that week. They're years in the past, right? I mean, there are shots that you might have seen at some point on a random practice round that come back to your mind of how to hit it. Like I'll relate this personally. So when I was on vacation, went and played this place. I was in the Outer Banks. Went and played this place in Corolla, whatever they call it, called the Currituck Club. And we got on the first tee. They'd shifted the ninth. So it's this 300, and we were playing a couple tees up, just friendly game, two people we didn't know. Guy was on vacation with his family. We were playing together. We're like, we'll play a couple boxes up, no worries. Got a little windy, and I decided I was going to try to ride the wind with my tee shot. Well, I thought I was riding the wind when I was trying to hit a cut, and I've been working on hitting a cut forever. And all of a sudden, I got to impact, and I hit the cut, but it was a lower, not totally low, but pretty low for me. cut. And it wound up 45 yards from the green. Well, again, you know, in fairways with longer grass, it rolled perfectly, exactly where I thought it needed to be. And in that moment, I realized I learned something about how to hit that shot. Well, less than a week later, when we wound up going to Kings Mill for a couple days, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, but went to Kings Mill for a couple days after the Outer Banks, went and played the Plantation course there. Well, that's a fairly tight course, and there are a couple holes where some of the teeing grounds were placed in a way where you kind of were forced to hit a certain type of shot. And I had to hit a low cut on a couple of different holes. And I did that successfully because I kind of backed into figuring it out on that first tee shot at Currituck. And that led to the round of my life. Shot a 64. And yes, it's a 5,700-yard golf course. It wasn't particularly difficult, but it was tight in many spots. But if I didn't know how to hit that shot because of that kind of seemingly innocuous moment, a better than expected result, maybe I wouldn't have played as well and with as much confidence the next time out. So all of that stuff kind of adds up, and it can add up from way far away, and it can add up from just a few holes prior. And when you tell the story of how someone wins or loses these big tournaments, it's important to not lose sight of those things. And I think that Wyndham Clark did that by taking the Wells Fargo Championship win, knowing he could win on a golf course that had a lot of long approach shots, long par threes, translated it to here, convinced himself he could do it, and then did it. That's a butterfly effect, totally. So it's really cool to watch that happen in real time, and I really enjoyed that facet of, and I always enjoy that facet of trying to explain what happened and why it happened. And there is some kind of inferred psychology to that, right? And some of it's probably just absolute nonsense, but a lot of it is not. I do firmly believe that you are the sum of your experiences or your inexperiences. And your job is to make the best of your failures and keep the best of your successes and not be blinded by them one way or the other, successes or failures. And I think Wyndham Clark did a good job with that. Rory McIlroy still figuring that out to some degree. But I want to get back to LACC, not as a venue, not as a golf course, but as a USGA championship venue. I think a lot of people enjoyed watching the golf course on TV, but it felt like, at least on TV, that the vibe there was just absent. And I think there were a bunch of reasons for that. And you may have seen some of this, so I'm sorry if I'm repeating it if you've seen it, but I think it's a worthwhile discussion to have. So the USGA only had about 22,000 to 23,000 tickets per day for the championship, for Thursday through Sunday. For whatever reason, they decided to limit the number of people at the venue. Probably traffic was a concern. I'm sure LACC didn't want 50,000 people a day at their venue, even though they probably had the room for it. And of those 22 to 23,000 a day, 13 to 14,000 of those were for corporate hospitality, for the VIP types that go getting to sitting in the air-conditioned tents and drink booze all day and really don't spend a whole lot of time watching the golf probably, and they're just there kind of to see and be seen. And then of the remaining 9,000 to 10,000 tickets per day that were available to the public that weren't hospitality, 40 to 50% of those went to Los Angeles Country Club members, their friends, and family. So, of the 22 to 23,000 people that were there each day, 4 to 5,000 of them were general public people. They weren't affiliated with the club, they weren't affiliated with the sponsor. They were just people who wanted to see the U.S. Open at Los Angeles Country Club. That created a crappy vibe because it seemed Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, as these guys were trying to score, and they were largely successful in scoring on this golf course, that there just wasn't a whole lot of, I don't know, atmosphere. And yes, I know that there are some people who are like, well, you know, I don't really like the Phoenix Open vibe. I don't really like when Bethpage gets crazy. But which would you prefer? Phoenix and Bethpage, or what we got that was basically a fancy library, outdoor library, for parts of meaty stretches, important stretches of the U.S. Open? And I think you would know the answer in your heart of hearts. And that was really sad to me, because Sunday was pretty decent. You had at least some decent noise, some decent energy out there. Not the best, but it was good enough, right? But to have only sold 22 or 23,000 tickets per day compared to a venue last year like the Country Club, which is, by the way, tight and not the best traffic-wise, they were selling 30,000 tickets. So you had probably at least 7, if not 10,000 more people there that were general admission, regular public people. And you had a tighter venue in which to do it. You had better crowds because, frankly, Boston sports fans are better than Los Angeles sports fans. And it just worked out better. So the next time that you do this in 2039, you're going to have to find a way to get more people on the property that aren't affiliated with Los Angeles Country Club. Plain and simple. I don't know how you do it. I don't know what the logistical challenges are. But you need to be able to do it because it kind of fell flat. Part of that was also the proximity of fans to the action points on the course. Just the way it's routed. Really hard to get fans near the 18th green because you've got 9-2. Just different considerations. I understand that. Maybe you reroute the golf course a little bit. I don't know. I don't know if that's plausible. But you need to come up with a way to have the championship end with just a big throng of people there watching the action unfold. And if you can't do that, I think you're going to have a similar vibe problem that you had this time out. But we'll see what happens. We got a decade and a half between now and then. A lot can change, right? A lot can happen in the world. We know that. I'm sure that there will be some kind of rollback. It almost seems inevitable. So set up maybe a different kind of thing 16 years from now for the rolled back ball, so to speak. Obviously, Los Angeles could be a different city in many different ways. Who knows what's going to happen? But I assure you that the next U.S. Open is not going to look a whole lot like this one. I mean, it's still going to be a golf tournament. There's still going to be 156 incredible players. There's still going to be some of these guys that are there. Many of them won't be. Most of them won't be. But it's going to be a different flavor to it, and I hope for the better. But the golf course itself, I think, was fantastic, and I'm glad they brought it to someplace a little bit different. All right, so final segment for this week's show. I alluded to it earlier, and this is not intended to be kind of a brag fest, but although it kind of is, but not really. So I shot the best round of my life over the weekend. Shot 64 on the Plantation course at Kingsmill, and kind of wanted to just talk about it. Not the shots. I don't want to give you a play-by-play, but just kind of the vibe, the atmosphere of a record round. And I want to hear from you about yours because, one, I love hearing people talk about playing great golf. So please send me your stories, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Shoot me a DM. I love talking about people's successes, whether they're mine or yours, and I love hearing about them. So please let me know about them. And then the other part of this was that the guy I played with, Jeff, who I went on vacation with, and his family. Jeff shot his career low round two. He shot 82. He was so we'll get to this, I guess. But when we got to the turn, so the Plantation, there's two courses at Kingsmill. There's the Pete Dye Design River course, and there's the Plantation course that's Arnold Palmer's. And I played both. And the Dye course ends on the James River, which is one of the many rivers in that part of Virginia, the Williamsburg area, which is really cool. If you ever get a chance to go down to Williamsburg and just spend some time, like if you're a history buff or a geek like I am, you would love it. You'd absolutely love it. Great food options, very solid brewery options, a couple distilleries that I haven't been to yet, theme parks, like you name it. Like there's a little something for everybody. And we stayed at Kingsmill Resort, and they were very kind to offer us an opportunity to stay in one of their cottages, which is right along the James River. And we agreed to pay freight for that. It wasn't just kind of a giveaway kind of thing. And they gave us a tea time at the plantation course. And we get over there, it's 8:30, and Jeff and I go hit some balls in the range. I wasn't hitting that great, honestly. And every time I think about a good round that I've had, I always feel like they were born out of rounds where I didn't think it was going to be much. Didn't think it was going to be that good. And then it turns out to be totally different and amazing in so many ways. So, you know, we're hitting balls. We were like, okay, it's probably close to time. Come back. And they paired us up with the father and son. And we met them on the first tee, shook hands with them. And we agreed, you know, what box we're going to play from. And we hit balls in the air. Jeff goes first, hits the absolute stuffing out of the ball. I mean, he's an athlete, hits the ball really well. Still kind of learning some of the finer points of golf, but the core is there. So he hits. I'm like, oh, wow, that's huge. And I get up there, try to hit a cut. Don't really pull it off. Like, it's pretty much straight. But it totally in play, no problem. And we look at the guys, Brad and George, and they seem like they realize that they don't want to play with us. Like, that they're not at that skill level. Whatever skill level they're at, they're not at that one. We don't know yet. So George hits, very nice man, winds up kind of just straight slicing it right into the woods, right near the driving range. And Brad kind of scuffs one, almost like a worm burner that gets through, somehow gets toward the fairway. And we basically get to the green on the first hole. Jeff hits it to gimme range, so he's one under through one. And I'm on the green, hit a nice enough wedge, I don't know, 15, 20 feet. I don't make the putt. And Brad and George are like, well, you guys can just play ahead. Like, just go for it. And we, you know, ask, are you sure? You know, we don't want to really do that. We're like, yeah, just go ahead. And, you know, if we have to, we'll join up again later. So all of a sudden we're a twosome, right? And now we're playing into a foursome because that's the way, you know, you get set up at a golf course. And we wind up, like I said, getting off to a good start. We're smoking drives, giving ourselves good opportunities to score. I wind up actually having to hit some shots I didn't really want to hit because I wanted to keep it moving. Because it turned out after we kind of got away from Brad and George, wound up playing in front of these or behind this foursome of guys for a while, like a good, I don't know, 8 holes, something like that, 9, 10 holes actually, beyond those first couple. And we realize they're back on us. Like, they're not, maybe not the best golfers, but they're keeping up. So we don't want to hold them up. So we kind of agree to hit lesser clubs than maybe we otherwise would. And it works. You know, we're playing great golf. And we get to the turn. And the ninth hole is 88 yards. Just a little wedge over a bunker to a tuck pin, just over the bunker. Almost aced it. So I'm like, okay, here we go. Like, I shot 31. Things are happening. This could be for real. And the really cool thing was, at that point, Jeff's adding up his score. And we had to add it up like 3 or 4 times because he did not believe that he had shot 37. But he did. And he had never broken 40 for 9. And yes, I understand this is a 5,700-yard golf course. It's fairly easy. I mean, it's not easy. Because there's a lot of tight landing areas. You got to play a certain style to be successful. But at that point, I think we both knew something could happen. And at that point, I think we kind of made a choice. Like, we're going to go for this. Now, Jeff kind of came in and struggled a little bit. And he wound up shooting 45 on the back. So he didn't play quite as well. But still shot 82. Incredible score. And he's got the card, and he's going to have it forever. And then this thing started clicking. Like, it just felt like it went like it was a dream. Like, I legitimately felt at points like I couldn't miss a shot, even though I know I could at any moment. And we wound up passing these guys that were in front of us, and then we kind of blitzed the last few holes. And you get down to it, and we got to the last hole, which is like 242 yards, short par four, basically a big dog leg left with the dog leg made by the fairway. No real trees, but there are trees smack dab basically in front of the green, 25, 30 yards, right? And so you have to either carry it over the trees or hit around them to get a chance to the green. And I stood on the tee and I was like, Jeff, this could be a career low round. I didn't know exactly where I was at that point, but I was pretty sure where I was. I'm pretty sure I was 7 under at that point. My career low is 66. So of two of them, I've won a par 71 and a par 72. And the par 72 one, it was super short. Like we were playing like 5,200 yards. So I didn't really think of it that way. The other one was at Tobacco Road on like the blue tee. So, you know, a more legitimate length. So this is somewhere in between those. Like, I think that you know, birdie here go a long way. Par, give me a career low. And I absolutely thinned the crap out of a 4-iron. I thought, okay, I'm gonna muscle up to the moment. I'm going to feel the adrenaline. I'm going to crush a 4-iron. It's going to go over the trees. I'm going to hit the green. I'm going to make eagle. I'm going to shoot 63. And we're going to finish this off like a story, you know, a movie. And I got so lucky. This 4-iron that I hit, like hit the back of a bunker parallel to the trees, kicked it left just in front of the bunker at greenside. And then I had a choice to make whether I wanted to kind of chip over this little hill down toward a kind of bowl front left pin or putt it over. And wound up making the right choice in the end. I putted it and I hit just over the hill and it came down to right about a foot, foot and a half. It was awesome. Tapped it in 64. Couldn't believe it. And the thing I really like about golf, and I think I've said this different times, different points, you can always get better. There's always an opportunity to learn or have your best day ever. And I feel like in the last 3 or 4 years, I've spent a lot of time trying to get better as a golfer, not as a scorer, because I spent a lot of time over the years trying to get better at scoring at golf, right? Just make more pars, make more birdies, see more putts go in from different parts of the course, you know, in different situations. Obviously, you make every 18 every round. But to learn now how to hit that low cut, how to hit a bigger draw, how to hit a smaller draw, how to hit it high, how to hit it low, how to do that with driver, how to hit a cut chip, you know, stuff like that. That I mean, like 5 weeks ago, I was just learning how to hit a proper bump and run with a wedge instead of like an 8-iron. Like I'm still trying to learn more stuff about golf, and yet there's still so much I can't do. I'm a very bad bunker player. Not colossally bad, but not very good. I need to put work into that. I'm not very good with a fairway wood in hand. I don't have one because I don't hit it very reliably. I mean, I have them at my house, but I don't have them in my bag. I still miss way too many greens with 8 and 7 irons, I think. There are so many things that I could get better at, and I can't wait to work on those things. But having days, and that's really what motivates me every time I go out and play. But having this opportunity to put up a super low number for me was a really cool, different thing, right? And I'm going to remember it, but I'll remember the score more than anything. I'll remember some of the shots specifically that I hit. Not so much the score. I mean, I'll know the number, but I'm not so worried about the hole by hole. And I was thinking about that over the course of it was, yes, it all came together and scored great. And I'm thrilled about that. But what I was most happy with was that I gave myself pretty much a scoring opportunity on every hole. Almost all of them. Not all of them, but probably like 4 or 5 of them. I just was happy to make par, right? But it's the notion that you can play well enough to put yourself in position to make a score. And that the variance may or may not happen that day for you, but the rounds I feel like I've gotten the most satisfaction out of over the years are the ones where I did the right stuff. The outcome may not have worked, but I did the right things and gave myself a chance to score, hit the right shots, executed the shots, even if that didn't mean the putt went in for birdie or par or whatever. And that's what keeps me so interested in golf, maybe more interested in golf now that I've been at it for This is my 28th year playing golf. And I'm still learning. I'm still getting better. Still trying to get better. I'm still trying to figure things out. And I know that there's a school of thought out there for optimization folks and people that are really focused on score, that you have to play optimized golf. You play the way that you know how to play. You don't deviate. You don't have to try new things. You just do what you do best and you make your score. And for a tournament golfer, I can understand how that's largely true. But for just an average person who just wants to play golf and have fun, I can't think that way. I think about golf as a growth journey. I think about it as you start in one place and you're just trying to improve. You're just trying to get a little bit better. I mean, I think that way about life. You're just trying to get a little bit better, trying to learn a new skill. You're trying to make maybe good decisions in your professional career. You're trying to become a better parent. You're trying to do the little things that help you learn. And sometimes you fail. Sometimes you take steps back. Sometimes you're frustrated. Sometimes you're wondering if you're ever going to get forward. But if you keep putting in the work, if you keep putting in the right effort, and you don't know that it's right until you get there, but then when it happens, the payoff was not the moment. It was that you did everything that you did to get to that point. And I think I've taken a lot of that approach more toward life, particularly professionally, the last couple of years. You may have noticed we've kind of changed some things at Golf News Net. You know, I don't write as much as I used to, but 30 to 40% less, which is kind of staggering. But started a radio station. We have something coming in the form of a 24/7 streaming video channel that's gonna, hopefully I can tell you more about come the end of July. Late July probably is when this is going to become a reality. And that was part of my goal. My long-term goal was to get from where I started, which was very little money in my checking account when I got let go from Yahoo Sports because they got acquired by Verizon or AOL or whatever. And then to getting to here of wanting to have a multi-channel golf company that could create opportunities for people and hopefully ultimately jobs and put people in this industry that's long suffered into a better position while also obviously and selfishly putting myself into a better position. And so I feel like being able to improve little by little, talking to people, learning things, getting better at certain things, making connections, not being afraid to fail, talking to people, like failing, getting better and failing. You know, those things add up. And I think that's what I love the most about golf. That's what I think I love the most about life, actually, is trying and failing and learning and getting better and eventually piling up to something that you personally can be proud of, even if no one ever understands what you've been through. Because at the end, that's all you've got is your story and what you've done and what you feel like you've accomplished to your soul and your spirit. And I think that's golf in a nutshell. All right, that's going to do it for us this week on the show. Thanks so much for listening. I appreciate it. I'm back with another show next week. We'll talk a little bit about the event of the KPMG Women's PGA Championship, which is the major this week on the LPGA Tour at Baltusrol, which would be really cool to talk about. We're going to talk a little bit about the designated stuff, I guess. I guess we'll start to get a better handle on what's going on with the Saudi thing. It was a nice respite, frankly, this week to not talk about that as much, but we'll get back to that, I guess, again next week, depending on what happens. And we'll talk about some other stuff as well. If you catch us a podcast on a platform that lets you do it, please leave a 5-star review. Helps us reach more people. And if you have any questions or comments, get a hold of me on Twitter or Instagram at Ryan Ballingy. We can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Check out Golf News Net Radio, available 24/7 on TuneIn and our primary partner, iHeartRadio. Please check it out. This is our best month ever. We're starting to grow. I think people are starting to see and appreciate what we're doing. Again, it goes back to what we were just talking about, but we appreciate your support there as well. If you have some time to listen to us, whether you're on a commute or you're in your car going somewhere, or you just kind of want to listen to something in your house that isn't the television or something similar. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Thank you again. We will talk to you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.